What is unknown at the moment is how the tariffs would be applied if they are indeed decided to go ahead with that.
Tariffs and quotas threaten to strain Sino-U.S. trade. It's Tuesday, February 20th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, a rape and murder causes protest in Pakistan. New life for an invasive pest. Special Olympians overcoming disabilities. Fighting superbugs. Will a robot take your job? It's all on today's VOA Asia. China has urged the United States to exercise restraint in imposing tariffs or import quotas after the U.S. Commerce Department recommended President Donald Trump take action against the practice of dumping cheap steel and aluminum imports on the U.S. market. Mr. Trump is expected to make his decision known by April. China warned it would, quote, take necessary measures to protect its own reasonable interests. The Trump administration last month imposed tariffs on imported washing machines and solar panels from Asia. IHS Global Insights chief economist Rajiv Biswas tells VOA's Victor Beatty from Adelaide, Australia, there is intense focus on what the U.S. will do.
What is unknown at the moment is how the tariffs would be applied if they are indeed decided to go ahead with that. Because at the moment, the discussion is about a potential 24% tariff, but a key question is whether the tariff will be applied, for example, to all steel exporting countries who export to the U.S., or will it be targeted with a sort of positive list of countries that would be, say, exempt from these higher tariffs. So the construction of how these tariffs will be phased in is very important as to how the reaction will be globally. Canada is actually the biggest exporter of steel to the U.S., accounting for about 16% of total U.S. imports. And then you've got Brazil, South Korea, Mexico as other big suppliers of steel. And China is way down the list and only supplies 1% of U.S. steel. So I think the rhetoric from China doesn't necessarily match the actual volume of steel they're exporting to the U.S.
Well, the president has already imposed tariffs on washing machines and solar panels, most of them coming from Asia. Are we on the cusp of a trade war?
Well, I certainly think we're facing a year when trade frictions could be one of the big threats to the global economic outlook. The world economy is doing very well right now. Things are looking very positive. But one of the important risks to the outlook for this year is rising trade frictions. And, of course, we've seen many years where trade liberalization has boosted world trade and world growth, according to most economic analyses. So this could be, you know, a retrograde step if we see countries putting in new tariffs and potential retaliation against the U.S. from other countries in response to these tariffs on steel and aluminium if they are actually imposed. So a lot will depend on how it's applied. The U.S. has already been using other ways of trying to address these concerns about unfair trade, particularly anti-dumping actions under WTO procedures. So those are probably the preferred course of action because they are allowed under WTO rules, whereas this is more a individual decision by the U.S. to pursue a certain course of action that could be challenged in the WTO system as well. So it could be a difficult year ahead in terms of trade policy and rising trade frictions, I think.
Meanwhile, Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull arrives in Washington this week for talks with President Trump. And according to the Australian Financial Review, citing an unnamed U.S. official, the two countries plus India and Japan are discussing a possible alternative to China's multi-billion dollar Belt and Road Development Initiative. It is described as a nascent or emerging plan. Rajiv Biswas said Japan is already involved in such development projects in countries like Vietnam, and a new multinational plan would be a welcome development for Asia, where some countries don't necessarily want to rely solely on Beijing for such assistance. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. United States open to discussing talks with North Korea. In India, Trump project buyers offer dinner with Trump Jr. Cambodian rice body faces own shortcomings. Volcano erupts in Indonesia, no fatalities or injuries reported. Native Australian species learning to avoid toxic cane toad. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia, also on our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The recent rape and murder of a 7-year-old girl in Pakistan's eastern city of Kasur is still causing shock and anger across the country. Child sex abuse was not a topic of public debate in the conservative Islamic country until Zainab Amin's murder. But now the issue of protecting children has come to the fore. Nilafor Mukhal of VOA's Urdu service has more in this report. It's narrated by Gary Butterworth.
Zainab's mother still cries for her 7-year-old daughter.
She was youngest in the family. She knew how to make her parents happy.
Zainab's brutal rape and murder triggered mass protests in Pakistan. But this was not an isolated incident, nor is sex abuse limited to little girls. In Punjab province alone, there are 1,300 cases of sexual abuse in the last 2 years, according to a recent report presented to the Pakistani Senate Committee. More than 1,000 were minor boys.
I was crying. He was hurting me. I cried the whole night.
Child rights activists say the problem is that most of the cases go unreported. Shame is a big obstacle because of societal taboos against talking about such issues. Another pressure is from the police or local influential people to sweep such cases under the rug.
This unfortunate incident happened to us, but no one was taking action. We ourselves handed over the culprit to police, but they released him, even though the case was registered against him. Why has he been released?
Human rights activists say cases rarely make it to the courts because Pakistan's legal system allows the victim's family to forgive the offender and accept what is often referred to as blood money. Lack of awareness by parents and the legal and medical process is another obstacle. Human rights activists say changes in the educational system are the first step to protect children from sexual abuse.
Our curriculum for children does not include anything on what kind of contact is inappropriate.
Many are calling for an appropriate way for parents and teachers to discuss the topic with children.
Kids are so small, but we have told them not to go with any strangers. And if someone tries to hold you or touch you, scream for help or run away.
While Zainab can never come back, many in Pakistan believe that her horrific murder should be a wake-up call to make necessary changes to safeguard the lives of thousands of children like her. For Nilufar Mughal, Gary Butterworth, VOA News, Washington.
Happening now in Asia, Philippine police and military say they have captured an Egyptian man believed to be an Islamic State recruiter in Manila. Femi Lasquid was presented to the media at the National Police Headquarters Monday. The Philippines has been repelling insurgents with alleged Islamic State ties in southern Mindanao. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us on this Tuesday edition of VOA Asia. Wildlife rangers at the World Heritage-listed Kakadu National Park in northern Australia have been told to abandon programs aimed at curbing numbers of one of the country's most destructive invasive pests. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports, cane toads have come to inhabit much of the tropical Australia area since they were introduced from Hawaii in the 1930s.
They are a voracious pest that's invaded vast swathes of northern Australia, and toxins in their bodies can kill goannas, crocodiles and snakes within minutes. They've devastated many native species, but researchers now say wildlife is recovering following the initial hit that occurred when the toads first arrived. In the Kakadu National Park in the Northern Territory, the toad invasion began in 2002. Rangers have now abandoned active efforts to remove the toads or stop their spread, because they believe native animals are learning to not eat the toads or are avoiding them altogether. This approach is supported by Professor Rick Shine, an evolutionary ecologist at the University of Sydney.
The Australian wildlife has proved to be far more resilient than I ever gave them credit for. They take a hell of a hit when the toads first arrive, but through time they begin to recover.
Cane toads are prolific breeders, and some estimates suggest there are as many as 1.5 billion in Australia, but it's impossible to know for sure. In the 1930s, the toads were thought to protect sugar plantations by eating the grubs that were devouring the crop. They were then sent around the world as a pest control means. In 1935, 101 toads arrived in Queensland, where they were bred in captivity and their progeny released to hunt and kill cane-destroying beetles along Australia's northeast coast. The experiment was a disaster. Not only could the toads not climb the sugarcane plants to catch the beetles, their numbers spread rapidly. The toads prey on insects and other small animals, but they're at their most dangerous when they're eaten by larger predators, such as snakes, goannas and freshwater crocodiles. A large gland on the toad's shoulder is loaded with fast-acting cardiac toxins. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia, scores of tourists were stranded for hours in Malaysia after a cable car broke down on the island of Langkawi. Cabins dangled over a jungle-clad mountain. Technical teams resorted to manual efforts to bring the cars to base camp, while a technical team replaced a faulty bearing to repair the system. Always up and running is VOA Asia Facebook. Stop by for the latest stories and features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, while Pakistan has participated in previous Olympic Winter Games, this year, for the first time, the country has sent two athletes to the Games, taking place in Pyeongchang, South Korea. Both athletes, Mohammed Karim, 22, and Syed Human, 26, are from the Naltar Valley, a village located in the northernmost region of the country. They also happen to be close relatives. VOA Asia intern Sana Ali spoke with them about what it's like to be representing their country on the international stage. Karim was the sole athlete from Pakistan at the 2014 Sochi Olympics, but this year he is accompanied by his nephew.
Yes, definitely. It feels very good. Before I was alone, and now, God willing, we have a team. He supports me and I support him, so it's a really good experience.
As a child, Karim started skiing for fun and took part in competitions that were organized for kids. He then joined the Shah Khan School, a ski school that was set up in the Naltar Valley. In 2007, he first visited Korea for a junior championship, after which he was sent to Austria for training. Once again, Karim is back in Korea, this time at the Olympics. He is participating in two alpine skiing events, giant slalom and slalom. For Karim, coming from a rural valley and now representing the country on such a big platform makes him very happy and proud. This was a sentiment his nephew Syed Haman, a member of the Pakistan Army and part of their skiing team, echoed. His interest in skiing, similar to Karim, started at home in the Naltar Valley. The Ski Federation of Pakistan opened a school in his village where he saw the locals training and was inspired to join himself. He was eventually sent abroad to train in cross-country, after which he began competing at a national level and now internationally.
After the Ski Federation of Pakistan sent me abroad for training in 2010 and 2011, it was on my mind and became my mission to represent Pakistan in cross-country skiing at the Olympics. And God willing, this dream of mine will come true.
Human will be competing in a 15-kilometer cross-country skiing event in Pyeongchang. The two skiers said their families back home in Pakistan are praying for them and are supporting them.
They are hopeful that we will return to Pakistan having given a great performance, inshallah. We will keep this hope alive and try to give our best performance.
While Naltar Valley is a remote valley and a difficult area to access by most means of transport, it has been central to the development of skiing in Pakistan. Shahid Nadeem, the Secretary General of the Ski Federation of Pakistan, accompanying the Olympics to Pyeongchang, believes that Pakistan, home to some of the world's highest mountains, has a lot of potential for winter sports.
As you know, that Pakistan is blessed with some of the world's highest mountains, like the K2, which is the second highest in the world, and it stands at 8,611 meter high. So we have a lot of potential for the winter sports. So Ski Federation of Pakistan was actually formed in 1990, and we have first ski resort in Naltar, which was established in 1958 to impart training to our pilots, Air Force pilots, and subsequently this facility was extended to civilians also, and eventually we had this Ski Federation of Pakistan came into being in 1990. And after that, our first participation at the international event in Vancouver was in 2010, where one of our ski athletes, Mr. Abbas, who also comes from Naltar, represented the country for the very first time at the Winter Olympic Games.
Nadeem hoped that by the 2022 Winter Olympics in China, Pakistan will be represented in even more events. He said his organization is trying to develop other winter sports, including ice skating, ice hockey, and snowboarding, and focusing on female participation with the hope to have a female qualify for alpine skiing at the 2022 Winter Games.
Our thanks to VOA Asia intern Sana Ali for that report. As the world watches the Olympic Winter Games in South Korea, some American athletes here in Washington are lacing up their skates to train for their own major sporting event. Special in every way, these young people work to overcome their developmental obstacles to compete for gold, just like the world's top athletes in Pyeongchang. Arash Arabasadi reports from Washington.
It's training day at the Fort DuPont Ice Arena in southeast Washington, D.C.
A lot of times if a kid has whatever the disability might be, they're really talented in other areas. So they never get that chance to have that exposure to another sport. And some of these kids are natural athletes.
These young people in skates are Special Olympics athletes. They compete in the world's largest sports organization for people with intellectual disabilities.
Some do not receive physical education classes, gym time, or the only time they get the chance to showcase their talent together is doing recreation. But here, we are a competitive, organized sport program that provides them with the opportunity that they may not get anyplace else.
These special needs athletes come from public and charter schools in the Washington area.
The goal of that is just to help them with their motor skills, help them feel more confident, help them introduce them to another sport. These kids are really just exposing themselves to something else and having fun at the same time.
Ice skating can be expensive, but through donations and their own nonprofit organization, everything from skates to coaches is free of charge to these competitors, leaving their focus on the ice.
You got to try something. You get on the ice, nobody's saying you got to be perfect. Just get the opportunity, make the best of your opportunity, and enjoy yourself.
It really installs that confidence and that idea that I might not be good at something, and that's okay. I just have to keep trying, and I'm going to get better at it.
These kids will compete in the Washington, D.C. chapter of the Special Olympics. Athletes just like them will do the same in regional contests across the U.S. Gold medal winners at the Regional Speed Skating Championship will qualify for a lottery that could send them to national or international Special Olympics competitions. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
This news alert from VOA Asia, Mount Sinabung on the Indonesian island of Sumatra has shot billowing columns of ash more than 5,000 meters into the atmosphere and hot clouds down its slopes. There are no reported fatalities or injuries from the eruption. All the big stories erupt online at VOA 60. Check them out along with VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, for years, doctors have been warning of a post-antibiotic age with resistant mutations leading to so-called superbugs, multi-drug resistant infections that can evade the medicines designed to kill them. VOA's Faith Lapidus reports the race is on to develop new drugs to treat these emerging mutating infections.
Bacteria have been developing resistance to antibiotics almost as long as we've been making antibiotics, according to Anthony Coates, founder of Helper B Therapeutics.
The human race made a huge mistake between the 1940s and the 1970s. We produced about 20 new classes of antibiotics with about 200 analogues, and we thought that was enough. Then we stopped making antibiotics, but bacteria became resistant to all of them. We mustn't fall into that trap again. We must produce our new antibiotics gradually in combinations.
Creating combinations is how Helper B is rejuvenating old antibiotics like colistin. Colistin is the last resort antibiotic against CRE, which causes severe and often fatal infections, and is starting to show resistance in China and parts of Southeast Europe. Coates calls CRE the bug that may end modern medicine.
And you can see in this control plate that they grow very nicely into little colonies.
Combining these booster drugs with existing antibiotics gives them the power to puncture the tough cell wall of CRE and other evolving superbugs, allowing them to effectively do their work.
And when we add the new antibiotic, you can see the effect. There are no bacteria growing at all.
By introducing a new booster every 30 years or so, Coates believes they can stay one step ahead of bacterial resistance and future-proof colistin and the other last-resort drugs in our medical arsenal. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
South Korea has been showing off a variety of robots at the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics, including one that carried the Olympic flame during the torch relay, a robot that can ski downhill and robotic fish in a tank of water. What does the not-so-distant future look like when an increasing number of robots enter the workforce? What types of jobs will they do? And would you be replaced by a robot? VOA's Elizabeth Lee spoke to experts in the field of robotics at the Consumer Electronics Show earlier this year for the answer.
From mowing the grass and cleaning windows to delivering things at a hotel, robots of all shapes and sizes are doing things humans have been doing for years. These machines can also do things humans cannot.
It can work all day, 24 hours a day, and it doesn't get emotional. It's always welcoming with a smile.
This Mandarin-speaking robot named Yo-Yo not only dances and tells jokes, he's also working in the service industry by communicating with humans.
Including in a hospital setting, in a clinic, to diagnose problems and to answer some medical questions. This is already happening in China.
Adapting technology to perform work done by humans is nothing new.
So go back to plows or go back to tractors, right? Those are the beginning of adding technology to work to make workers more productive. When you put a spreadsheet in an accountant's hands, you make that accountant much, much more productive. So the same thing with robots.
Robots are getting smarter. As a demonstration, this robot is playing the English word game Scrabble against a human opponent.
Its main point is not to replace people's jobs. It's to help people do really complicated work.
In addition to complicated work, robots such as this RoboMantis do dull, dirty, or dangerous work so a human doesn't have to.
They don't need to be in those situations. Confined spaces, refinery tank cleaning, things like that where you can take advantage of a robot that can go in and work for hours on end without endangering a human in those situations.
Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Las Vegas.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find us on iTunes and SoundCloud if you'd like to download our program. Stream us online at VOA Asia Facebook or at our website, voanews.com. And you can always find us on the radio wherever you happen to be in Asia, like the Philippines if you're in Quezon City. Check us out at DZUP 1602 AM radio at the University of the Philippines, Diliman. Thanks to everyone there listening today. And our thanks, as always, go to Director Tracy Carter, our engineer Jimmy Cook, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a super day.